uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. SubT, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. SubT.com.
Fred Film Radio. I'm Matt Micucci from the 64th Berlin International Film Festival.
Io sono Valentina Pompili al Tokyo International Film Festival.
Soy Antonio Becker y estoy aquí con
internationalen Filmfestspielen in Berlin. Mein Name ist Beatrice Beden.
Ahlan bikum fi Fred Film Radio.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. The show is hosted and produced by yours truly, Matt Micucci, coming to you pre-recorded from a secret European location and brought to you through the power of the internet. My friends, this is the first episode following the latest edition of our major annual coverage of the Venice Film Festival. This was actually the 10th year that Fred covered the oldest and one of the most prestigious annual international film festivals in the world. We hope you were able to follow our coverage, but in case you weren't, you should know that you will find our videos on our YouTube channels and our social media. And of course, you can also listen to all podcast conversations in English, Italian, French, Spanish and more on fred.fm. That's our website, fred.fm. There's more content that is still being uploaded, and really, there weren't all that many people that we managed not to interview, which is quite remarkable. So throughout this show, we will be revisiting some of our highlight moments from Venice and talk about some of its major award winners, but we will also be moving ahead and looking towards the upcoming edition of the Zurich Film Festival this year, which is going to take place in Switzerland, and it's really just around the corner, and we will be talking about it specifically with its artistic director, Christian Jungen. I also urge you to stay to the end to find out which film will be named our popcorn classic. So fire up an Audiotini and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air. This is the Big Fred Tuesday.
Fred.
Last Night in Soho was certainly one of the most anticipated films presented at the 78th Venice International Film Festival. Angelo Cerbi had a chat with its director, the wickedly talented Edgar Wright, and its writer, Christy Wilson-Cairns. Take a listen.
It was a fun ride this morning when we saw it. It was really good, but really intense, and not that, there is not that irony that was used to be in your films before. So it's your fault, Christy, or it's his fault? I mean, whose fault is that?
Well, I mean, I think it was something I'd been building up to. I wanted to do a more serious film or something that was, you know, I've done genre films before, but like you said, they've usually been like funnier. Like, but this is, I knew, because it's like serious subject matter and it is darker and more intense and something that I, you know, kind of in strange ways, kind of very personal to me. It's something that I've been thinking about for a long time. And so I had conceived the story like at least 10 years before we started writing the screenplay together, and sort of, you know, when I met Christy through Sam Mendes, we started chatting about just everything. And then when I found out that she used to live in Soho, then I said, oh, I want to tell you this idea for a film that I have. So, you know, we started talking about
that. And of course, for you, Christy, was like a dream.
Oh my God, an absolute dream. Yeah, no, we went out on a night out in Soho, and I was like, oh, I used to live above this strip club, and this is the pub I work in, and blah, blah, blah. And he told me the story of Last Night in Soho, and it just blew my socks off. I loved it.
The really challenging thing for the film is to keep the balance between these two periods, and there are two periods, and there are and then this kind of the trip into the darkest part of both periods. So was it difficult to keep this balance? Because it was very tricky. It was very easy to make it wrong, you know, to go the wrong way.
Well, I think maybe the point of the whole movie, in a way, is that the lesson is don't romanticize the past.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might think that you want to go back in time to the 60s, but what you're probably imagining is the perfect world version of that.
Yeah, of course.
And so I guess really that's what the movie's about, and that's the sort of the kind of the hard truth is that you could go back in time, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's all going to be great. And then worse still is that, like, you could go back in time and be helpless to change the future. That's sort of, you know, I don't mean to sound terribly bleak, but that's sort of the darkness of the story. story in a way.
Yeah. How do you work together? I mean, Woody was a son, was you, so you every year you write and then he reads and he decides you change. So it was like, oh, was like more four hands job.
Yeah. Well, Edgar had the story already. So I came on board. We rented an office in Soho and then we sat and we basically, with a whiteboard, put lots of cards up, discussed the characters, discussed the scenes. And then we just started writing. It went back and forth between the two of us. I mean, he did a lot of the work.
Yeah. Well, my last question is, of course, about the great Diana Riggs. So how did you get her involved and how was to work with her on her last film?
I mean, it's difficult to talk about because it's sort of not just making the movie, but I became friends with her through the making of the movie in terms of I saw her quite a number of times after we finished filming. So it's desperately sad that she's not with us anymore. And the only thing to take away from it is that how lucky are we that we got to work with her. And so working with her was a dream. I've been a fan of her since I was a little kid watching The Avengers. And the original Avengers.
The original Avengers.
I just have to stress that. She was just... It was just like the perfect person to play the part. And she was just so, like... Such a kind of amazing, funny, like, sort of divine presence. Like... I used to call her DDR, Dame Diana Rigg. And, I spoke to her like, you know, we worked on the movie only a couple of weeks before she passed away because she was such a pro, such a professional that she wanted to finish her work on the movie. And I knew that, like, through her daughter told me that she'd been kind of, when she was calling friends of hers to say goodbye, it was her running joke to say, like, don't think I'm not working, I'm still doing this movie.
and she did, like, a hell of a role, actually. Well, thank you very much. Thanks a lot to Edgar, Wright and Kirsty Wilson-Cairns from the film The Last Night in Soho here at the Venice Festival. Thanks for being with us. I'm Angela Cherby for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Thank you.
Fred.
Joining us at this time is Zurich Film Festival's artistic director, Christian Jungen. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hi, Matt.
The 17th edition of the Zurich Film Festival is fast approaching. What are the dates for this year's festival?
So we're kicking off on September 23rd and are running through October 3rd. And we are showing 164 films, among which 25 world premieres. And we're looking forward to welcome the guests in Zurich.
Not bad. September 23rd also happens to be my birthday, so what a coincidence. I also feel like I should ask this question, given the times that we've sort of gone through, and to some extent they're still kind of going through. Will this be physical, online, or a hybrid, a mixture of the two?
No, it's an in-person festival. Okay. We're advocates of the theatrical experience, and we always said either we're going to do it in person, in theaters, where filmmakers can personally introduce the film to a real audience, or we're going to cancel it. So we never considered a hybrid or an online version.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. You know, it's good to be back, to be able to go back to the cinemas. And, of course, this festival is going to be a great event to celebrate the theatrical experience. But after all of that, Christian, I also feel like we should provide our listeners with a proper introduction to the Zurich Film Festival. So would you mind telling us a little bit about the history of the festival and maybe even the characteristics of the festival that you feel set it aside from others?
The Zurich Film Festival is now a teenager. It's 17 years old and it's grown very rapidly. It was started by two people, not from the film field, but they were very marketing savvy. And today it's the second biggest festival in the German-speaking realm and the biggest one in autumn, with 117,000 visitors the last time. The Zurich Film Festival is kind of a springboard to the Oscars from the 10 Best Picture winners of the last years, 6 played at Zurich. This is one of the reasons why Americans love to showcase their film, to position them for the Oscar. But in the competition, we only play first, second, and third features. So we're dedicated to the young filmmakers, and we're always happy when we can make discoveries and give them the golden eye, which helps young filmmakers to do their next film and to get some attention by the critics and the media.
So I read in a press release that you stated that this year the Zurich Film Festival celebrates the comeback of Hollywood. Is that right? And what does that mean?
Well, I took over last year in January, and I'm very Hollywood friendly. I always said that Hollywood makes the best and the worst films in the world, but you have to focus on the best ones. And sadly, last year there wasn't much possible because the studio withheld most of their highly anticipated titles. Some of them we could bring to Zurich this year. For example, we have the premiere of No Time to Die, the second screening in the world, only 15 minutes after the beginning of the world premiere in London, or The Last Duel by Ridley Scott, another high prestigious author Hollywood film after a script of Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. So we are happy to have Hollywood back, also on the level of the guests. We are giving our Golden Icon Award to Sharon Stone. We celebrate her achievements as an actress. And our Game Changer Award, which is for an industry person who had an impact on the future of the industry, goes to Pam Apte, the studio boss of MGM, because she rebuilt the studio. And they have so many great films, No Time to Die, The House of Gucci, or the new film by Paul Thomas Anderson. And they are releasing all of them to theaters, which is very important for all the exhibitors. And that's why we acknowledge her achievement with the Game Changer Award.
That sounds awesome. And let me also say, make a little joke and say that the fact that the new 007 film is playing in the Zurich Film Festival is pretty appropriate given its award, you know, the Golden Eye Award. So it makes a
Absolutely.
Lot of sense.
Absolutely. That's a good fit. And also Switzerland in terms of spectators is one of the best Bond territories worldwide.
Right.
James Bond is extremely popular. Many films were partly shot in Switzerland, and that's why I think people will line up massively for that film. And since the moment that we announced the premiere, everybody calls me and wants some tickets, old friends from school or even politicians. So I feel there is a lot of energy on this film.
So in the introduction, you kind of told us a little bit about the numbers in terms of how many films will be screening and how many premieres will actually be showing at the Zurich Film Festival. And let's try and dissect the program a little bit more. I picked out a couple of things that I really wanted to talk about. One of them is really interesting. I think it's interesting also for cinephiles like me who like to discover cinemas of different parts of the world. And I believe that there will be a regional focus on young Tunisian cinema. Is that right?
Yes, we highlight every year a country where there is something going on, where a new generation makes fresh films. And Tunisia is our first guest country from Africa. And I think we in Europe should start to look towards Africa, because in 1950, they had a fifth of our population in Europe. And in 50 years, they will have 10 times more people living there. And a lot of them want to come to Europe. So it's a good moment to start looking at them to see how they live. In Tunisia, they are 10 years after the Arab Spring. They still have a conservative regime, but a very young population who wants liberties. And this young cinema shows the liberties and helps to establish them. It's a very accessible cinema. For example, the film The Man Who Sold His Skin by Kaouter Benhania was the first Tunisian film ever to be nominated for an Oscar. And it tells the story of a refugee who makes a tattoo on his back, which becomes a sensation in the art world. And then suddenly there is the absurd situation that as an artwork he can travel, but not as a human being. And starting from this situation, a comedy with satirical tones and political tones takes its way. And it's a good example of this young, fresh Tunisian cinema we're going to celebrate.
We'll be back for more on the 2021 Zurich Film Festival in a moment.
Fred Film Radio.
We're back with Zurich Film Festival's artistic director, Christian Jungen. And we've been kind of talking about some of the things that will be taking place at this year's Zurich Film Festival edition. Another thing I wanted to highlight is it true that there will be a thematic section on sexuality?
We have a section called Hashtag, where every year we have a theme or a topic which trends on social media, example on Twitter. This year it's Let's Explore, but S-A-X, sex is written big, because we are 4 years after Me Too, and many observers said, okay, we're entering a neo-prudery age where you can show nothing at all, no nudity. But we found many films on corpses, on sex, and it's not conservative. Cinema hasn't become conservative, but what has changed is that like 20 years ago or 30 years ago when Sharon Stone became a star, the gaze was mainly male and desirable, and now you have more female gazes, you have also more diversity in sexuality, and in Switzerland we have a referendum the next weekend on gay marriage, and this section is also a tribute to the diversity of sexualities and a statement that not everything is becoming conservative after Me Too.
And this is something that I just realized about the festival because I just received the press release a couple of hours ago. But is it true that it will also be a celebration of film music?
Absolutely. This is a pillar of our festival that we highlight film music, and we're going to award Michael Denner with the Career Achievement Award. He's one of the top composers from Hollywood who did the scores for most of Ang Lee's films and won an Oscar for Life of Pi. And he's also the president of the International Film Music Competition, where composers from all around the world make a composition for a short film. There is a conference called Soundtrack Zurich, where composers come in town and exchange over their métier. And for us, it's important to stress that film music matters, especially in the age of the streamers. Music has become more important in films because it makes the productions more emotional, and film music is in the spotlight at the Zurich Film Festival.
We talked about films, but there will also be a series in the program, right?
We are showing series on the big screen because it's a format that many big auteurs like David Fincher or Martin Scorsese are practicing. We have a Netflix series called The Billion Dollar Call, which we can show as a world premiere, and it's about a big corporation stealing the idea from some kids in a garage. And the series is a section which is free. You don't have to pay entry or to pay for the ticket. And it's also a way to lure a younger audience, a lot of students, to the festival. And it's one of our most lively sections where there are always heated debates after the screening.
Right, excellent. So again, I mean, I feel like we're only kind of scraping the surface when it comes to this year's program. But is there any other highlights that you'd like to mention that we haven't already?
Well, one of the highlights is that we give our tribute to award to Paolo Sorrentino, which is one of my favorite directors since 20 years. And he has a new film called The Hand of God, which makes reference to the goal Diego Armando Maradona's shot by his hand in 86 against the English. And it's a very personal film by Paolo Sorrentino. He returns to his hometown Naples. And it's a film about this city, about Italians, about football, and about the role Diego Armando Maradona played in his life. And we're happy that Sorrentino will personally introduce this film, and I will personally do a masterclass with him. It's the first time in Italian, because he prefers to speak Italian, where he talks about his career. And in my mind, Sorrentino is the real successor of Fellini, because he has a very artful style, but he also understands cinema as a mean of criticizing society. And he's a very interesting filmmaker, and I'm so happy that he will come to Zurich to present his films. We also dedicate a retrospective to his oeuvre.
That's awesome. So we talked about the films, but is there an industry section too that is part of the Zurich Film Festival?
We have an industry conference called the Zurich Summit, where you know, the most important players from Hollywood meet the players from the European industry. It takes place in the Grand Dolder Hotel on a hill overlooking the Lake of Zurich. Then there will be conferences on how to restart the theatrical business. There is also panels on the role film festivals will play in the future. I think festivals have become more important. They are the motor in promoting films for the theatrical releases, but they've also become more important when it comes to the award season. Because years ago, it was clear that the film who did the biggest box office, let's say Titanic, will have the most Oscars. This has changed today. It's not clear what is a box office success, because many films are in theaters only for 2 weeks, and then they come out on streaming services. And on the other hand, the Academy has diversified, has let in much more members, non-Americans, non-whites, and the taste of the Academy has changed. And when it comes to position films for the Academy Awards, the autumn festivals play more important roles than years ago, and that's one of the topics we are going to discuss at the Zurich Summit as well.
That sounds very interesting. A lot of discussions about the current state of the film industry and beyond at the Zurich Film Festival. So I think we kind of provided a good overview of what will be taking place in Zurich this year. So I'd like to end it with something else now that's more related to Switzerland as a country and its film industry, because after all, we are talking about a festival not only that is based in Switzerland, but also that kind of aims to represent and help the Swiss film landscape, I feel, with such things as the Emerging Swiss Talent Award for Swiss film debut, which is a great initiative. But I'd like to sort of end our chat with another relatively broad question. Feel free to answer it in any way you like. But what do you feel is the current state of Swiss cinema?
Well, Swiss cinema was a problem child for many years. It wasn't represented in the big A festivals. Film didn't have legs. This is changing rapidly. We have auteurs like Ursula Meyer who win awards in Berlin or are represented in Cannes and Venice. But also in the home market, the Swiss films have a lot of success lately. And Zurich has always been the place where these big auteur films started. This year, we opened the festival by the new film by Michael Steiner, And Tomorrow You Will Be Dead. It's a hostage drama about two Swiss who 10 years ago were taken hostages by the Taliban and were the first foreigners ever to be able to escape the prison of the Talibans. We have seen this film months ago, have invited it, and now that the Taliban took over in Afghanistan, it's kind of a hot topic. Should you show such a film as an opening night film? But I think cinema is the mirror of our times. Cinema should be political, and that's why we stuck to the plan and will show this Swiss production as our opening night film. It's one out of 24 Swiss films we are going to show. And I mean, 2/3 of the Swiss film industry are based in Zurich, and I see it as our role to also highlight the best of the production, which is homegrown.
The Zurich Film Festival takes place from September 23rd to the 3rd of October this year. And Christian, it's been a pleasure chatting with you about it. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for the interest, and it was a pleasure for me too.
Fred Film Radio.
One of the most anticipated new films is certainly The Card Counter, directed by Paul Schrader. Angelo Cerbi was able to interview one of its stars, Tiffany Haddish, in Venice. Take a listen.
Your character is really vibrant and very funny in a very dramatic situation, but it's not, I mean, you're light, you bring lightness, but you're not cheap, you're not easy. I mean, there are layers of deepness in your character too. And did you know anything about the world of poker before shooting the film?
Yes, I know a little bit about it. I have quite a few friends that are professional poker players. So, and it's funny, before I went to film the film, before I went to go shoot, I was talking to some of those friends and I was asking them about, you know, their representatives, and they were like, oh, they're slimy. And they like introduced me to a couple of them. I'm like, oh, I am definitely not going to play Lalinda like any of these guys. But I had a better understanding of how that world works.
But so, when you work with Paul Schrader this time, did he ask you to be yourself, or did he give you some specific indications for playing the role?
He gave me some specific indications for playing the role, and, you know, was on me about pulling back. Like, you know, I got a big personality.
I got a big personality.
So to tone that down to a certain extent, but then, like, push on this thing, you know, it was a lot of adjustments that were made. Yeah.
You said that in one interview that this role for you was like, she was like a vulture or an owl.
Yeah.
Why you say that?
Because she was like watching her prey, right? She watched everybody, watch how they play, watch how they move. She was able to figure out that, you know, Willard tells he was counting cards. She knew that he was very good at what he does because she studied him, right? Vultures, owls, you know, eagles, although they study their prey. And then they get them, right? They swoop in. And that's what I did. I was sitting over there just watching. And then I came in, swooped in. Hello.
Hello.
You know, come and get my prey.
And then Lalinda came.
And then Lalinda did come.
Listen, was it, I mean, you switch. I mean, you're a comedy actress most of your career.
Right.
How easy was to switch into drama? If it was not even a switch, I don't know.
It's way easier. I think it's way easier. It feels a little boring to me sometimes.
Really?
Yeah, to do drama sometimes is boring because, you know, in comedy, you have to use certain devices, right? You use the cadence of your voice, your hand movements, the way you move your face, gestures and all these things so that, at least for me anyways, I want my comedy to transcend past language barriers, right? Mm. Somebody might not understand what I'm saying, but they know it's funny. You understand what I'm saying?
Right, yeah.
You know the comedy is there. You might not know exactly what those words are, but you can see that it's funny. In drama, well, it's more still. It's more getting your point across with the words and the emotion, but not so much face, not so much, you know.
Yeah, it's more inside.
It's more inside, and you let people come in, right? As opposed to emoting out. So, that's way easier.
Actually, you look very comfortable in it.
I am very comfortable. I mean, when I'm in regular life, that's what I do, right? Yeah. I'm very chill. I'm very comfy. And I'm serious. I am a serious person, but I do like to have fun. Much like Lalinda likes to have a little fun.
Yeah.
But she's hard.
But she's there.
Yeah.
She's on. One last question. Which is your favorite Paul Schrader film?
Cat People.
Oh, God, you're right.
It's my favorite.
Why?
I don't think it's his favorite, but it's my favorite.
What
and I'm
that?
Always bringing it up because it was the first time. Okay, first of all, it was the first time that I saw a woman. I was a kid. So it was the first time I saw a woman be beautiful and transform into something black. That meant a lot for a little black girl. Like, oh, she transformed into this. And they were talking about Africa. And they were talking about different things. And then they got really weird. But they got really weird and kind of scary. But when I saw her turn into a black cat, that to me was like, I don't know why it was such a big deal for me. But it was. And it still is.
But it was actually a fascinating film. And she was so gorgeous.
So beautiful.
Both as a cat and as a woman.
Yeah, at both. And it was my first time seeing nipples. Through a dress.
Really?
She was wearing that white t-shirt.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Her nipples was coming through. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, I've never seen that before.
So you were enlightened by it.
I was definitely enlightened. And I was like, oh, you can walk around. Then I started seeing it all the time. You know? But I was like, that would open my mind. And then I watched everything that he did from that point on. And that was like in 89
or something, yeah.
89. I just know that I was young. I was one. Okay, maybe I was 10, but still.
Well, thanks a lot to Tiffany Haddish for being with us for the film The Card Counter by Paul Schrader at the Venice Festival. I'm Angela Cherby for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
Cinephile, believe it or not, there was more that happened at the 78th Venice International Film Festival than Ben Affleck's appearance on the red carpet to mark the premiere of Ridley Scott's new feature film, The Last Duel. That's a joke, of course, because it was an excellent edition of the festival, if I may say so myself. So it's time to dedicate a segment of this show to highlight some of its winners. Firstly, the festival jury was helmed by Bong Joon-ho, and they awarded the Golden Lion for Best Film to The Happening, a French film set in the 60s and dealing with abortion, directed by Audrey Duan. Interestingly, this award comes a year after another female filmmaker, Chloe Zhao, was awarded the Golden Lion for Nomadland, and only a couple of months after Julia Ducournau won the Palme d'Or in Cannes for Titane. We've got an interview with Diwan on our French channel that you can check out if you speak the language, just like we have an interview with Paolo Sorrentino available for you on our Italian channel. His new film, The Hand Hand of God was awarded the Grand Jury Prize and is described in the press notes as the Italian filmmaker's most personal work yet. The Silver Lion for Best Director went to Jane Campion for The Power of Dog. Penelope Cruz and John Arcilla won acting awards, respectively, for Parallel Mothers and my personal favourite film of the 78th Venice Film Festival, an almost 3.5-hour Filipino gangster movie called On the Job, The Missing Eight, directed by Eric Matti. We pretty much have interviews available across different channels with all of the major winners and more. For all other winners, as usual, I suggest checking out the Google machine. But anyways, we'll be back with more film stuff after this.
Fred.
Maggie Gyllenhaal was another of the award winners in Venice this year. She specifically received a prize for best screenplay for her directorial debut, The Lost Daughter. Angela Cerbi interviewed her there. Take a listen.
You're here. This is your first time as a director. How does it feel?
It feels amazing. Yeah, it really does.
The film is taken from a book by Elena Ferrante by the same title that you were very fond of.
Yeah.
What was it that brought you to the idea of turning it into a film?
Well, I started with the Neapolitan novels, My Brilliant Friend, like many people did. And I had never read anything like them before. I felt like she was saying out loud in those books truthful things about being a woman in the world that I just had never heard expressed. And it kind of scared me because some of the things she was talking about were really dark, and I related to them. And then it also really comforted me to think, okay, somebody else is feeling this. Someone else is writing about this and thinking about this. And I thought how kind of dangerous and exciting it would be to recreate an experience like that, not alone in your room, before you go to sleep in the dark, but in a room full of people in a movie theater, sitting next to maybe your daughter or your mother or your husband, to feel something really truthful being said out loud in a situation like that, which is why I wanted to adapt it.
Which actually is, it's really daring too, because you have to say something that is not socially accepted. It's not what people wanted to hear, but it's probably what most women feel about, for example, being a mother, because all the film is
not socially accepted, but I think people want to hear the truth expressed. Mm-hmm. When you know, even like comedians, sometimes they'll say something and you're like, oh my God, did you just say that out loud? That's true, but we're not supposed
never
to say
that.
You know, and then you're like, makes you laugh or maybe makes you cry or, you know, whatever. It makes you feel alive, you know, so, yeah.
And how do you work about adapting this? Because the book has this two level of narrative, the present and the past. In the film, there is a very continuous alternative editing of the past and the present. How was it for you to keep it together in terms of writing and of directing?
It's interesting. I mean, the movement from the past to the present was very, very carefully constructed. And although certainly elements of it changed as we were cutting, where the past came in never changed from where I had originally conceived it to be. I have a lot of feelings about this. Like, I think it's okay if when Jesse Buckley comes in, you don't know who she is, where you are, why are we here. I like that feeling. I actually think about the Italian film, what is it called? I'm forgetting. It's Matteo Garrone.
Which one of Matteo Garrone?
I'm just so jet lagged. Gamora.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Right? Isn't that Matteo Garrone?
Yeah.
Gamora. When I was watching that movie, I was, where am I? Who is that person? How is that person related to this? Wait, where am I going? And, of course, if you keep it going too long, you lose people. But if you keep it just a little, everyone's on the edge of their seat, using their mind and their heart to figure out where you are. And so, in terms of that, I wanted that. I wanted I was inspired by that. And then eventually you start to settle into, okay, I think this might be Leda Young. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the biggest risk in the film, to be honest. Two actresses playing the same person. But isn't it wild how it works?
Yeah, it works.
It's this kind of poetic.
It works because actually you ask for some attention from the audience, but once that you got it, it just goes.
I think it works? Because everyone knows they're not the same person. They're two famous actresses, and we know who they are. But fundamentally, what they're saying, what they're doing is honest. Mm-hmm. And so you go with it, you know? It becomes like a poem, I think.
Yeah. And there is another thing that I wanted to ask you about the pace of the film, because it has like this thriller taste to it continuously. So you always waiting for something bad to happen because there is a construction towards this. Was it something that you were looking for, and was it difficult to make it?
I wanted to use the language of a classic thriller, even with the kind of objectification in the beginning of Nina, her body. Oh, we're used to seeing like, you know, Monica Vitti and a kind of, you know, to play with all of that. To set that up as the language and then flip it, you know, and then change it. And then what ends up happening, what ends up being dangerous is very different than what you think is going to end up being dangerous.
Absolutely.
You know, and in fact, Nina gets up from her, you know, position of being, you know, objectified and admired and speaks and has needs and hunger and, you know, I did intend to do that.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks a lot to Maggie Gyllenhaal, director of The Lost Daughter here at the Venice Film Festival, first feature, so good luck for that.
Thank you.
I'm Angela Cherby for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, it's almost time for us to say goodbye, but not before the much-awaited weekly Popcorn Classics segment, where I highlight a film that, to me, is essential cinephile viewing. More often than not, these are films I feel are not talked about enough, and this week I chose to talk about a movie that is really one of the only cinematic endeavors by someone who, in my opinion, is one of the greatest stand-up comics who ever lived, Norm Macdonald. Dirty Work from 1998, directed by sitcom favorite and blue comic Bob Saget, finds Norm Macdonald in the starring role, supported by Artie Lang, as a man who comes up with a get-rich-quick scheme to start a revenge-for-hire business and get the right kind of money that his best friend's father needs for a heart transplant. Gloriously outrageous and fueled by bad taste, this film rightly has a passionate niche of die-hard fans and really was an iconic Norm Macdonald vehicle. The fact that it remained his only cinematic project worth talking about makes it all the more iconic. Sadly, Norm Macdonald recently passed away, and I, like many other fans of his, rushed to watch the film again, only to find that, yes, it really is absolutely underrated and well worth reevaluating. Shocking, but quietly charming, and featuring the final on-screen performance by the late, great Chris Farley. It is something of a landmark film of a specific time in American comedy filmmaking, and while it would truly never have stood a chance against any Jim Carrey vehicles, the fact that it didn't hold any such ambition testifies to its independent spirit that remains one of the most appealing things about Dirty Work, which may also be why everyone looks like they're having such a jolly good time being a part of it, including Don Rickles. For this reason and more, I will give Dirty Work 5 bags of popcorn, 5 cups of soda, and a lifetime supply of Man Great. Norm Macdonald, we speak your name, and we salute you. And that brings us to the end of yet another episode of the Big Fret Tuesday. Thank you so much for joining us. Join me again next week for more cinephile exploration and conversation. Be sure to also check out all of our content from the Venice Film Festival just past, across our various channels, and in multiple languages as well. Till the next time, this is Matt McCucci signing off. Stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong. Most importantly, stay cinephile and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred.
Benvenuti su Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
This is Fred Film Radio, I'm Eddie Bertotti.
Clémence Ferry-Latour for Fred Film Radio, en direct du Festival de Cannes.
簡単にその先生の作品のあの紹介を...
Alain Beconfi, Fred Film Radio, Malcolm O'Mahragan.
Fred, the Festival Experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio.
24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.